Welcome to The Hidden Gin, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
You might recall the story I shared much earlier in the season about family friends that had a number of young sons who used to scare the daylights out of me and my siblings with gin tales from their village back home in Pakistan. Frankly, I was pretty disappointed that our own relatives never shared any gin stories, but I chalked it up to the fact that we were city folk. Maybe it was in the villages that the real gin action took place, and unfortunately, we didn't have a village. In my preteen years, I got more interested in the occult, and because my own family had pretty much nothing to contribute, I sought out every book on the subject in the tiny local library where we lived in Western Maryland. Demonic possession, haunted houses, vampires and zombies, UFOs, well, they were all gin to me. I was always walking the line between fear and fascination, but I couldn't get enough. And it was in those books that I learned that people didn't have to be hapless bystanders in supernatural encounters. We could actually control those encounters, communicate with these forces, even summon them. And I wanted to try. So I saved up the $14 needed to buy a Ouija board from Kmart. No small feat for a kid in the 1980s. And I fearfully gave it a try, alone, in my bedroom one night. My little sister refused to join me, and my little brother, well, he was too little, so it was just me and that board. I admit that my attempt was half-hearted. I both wanted, but didn't want, to conjure up spirits. The first and only question I asked when I positioned that tear-shaped, clear plastic pointer on the board was, "Hi, is anyone there?" Then suddenly I thought, what if I end up inviting things into our house I couldn't get rid of? My parents would kill me. So I quickly folded up the board and shoved it back into the box, not waiting for an answer to my question. I blew out the candle that was melting on my dresser, and the next day I gave the board to a girl at school. And I never asked her if it worked or not. I wasn't sure if I really wanted to know. The next time we met those family friends, though, I told the boys what I had tried, and they laughed at me. That wasn't the way to do it. A cheap board from Kmart? I really thought that would be enough. No, if you wanted to summon the djinn with all their powers and make sure that you're able to control the powers, it takes a test of your own fortitude and courage. Back in their village, a few brave souls had taken the test. Some had passed, but most had failed. The summoning required a person to first spend 30 days in prayer and fasting to purify and prepare their bodies and souls for the ordeal. At the end of 30 days, you had to spend the night in a cemetery, seated inside a tight circle drawn in the dirt. Throughout the night, demons would terrorize you, trying to get you to flee in fear from that circle. But you can't leave the circle. You can't sleep, you can't eat or drink, you can't stretch an arm or a leg. You must spend the entire night, from the time the sun sets to when dawn breaks, keeping still and reciting prayers. If your prayers ever falter or you doze off, or even so much as your foot slides across the boundary of that circle, you fail the test. And failing the test didn't mean you got a do-over. Failing the test meant you'd be killed by the same djinn you were trying to summon. So this was not an undertaking for the faint of heart or the wishy-washy like me. It was high risk, but also high reward. Because if you passed that test and made it through the night, you now controlled the djinn that you summoned, and all of their powers were now your powers. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, and I'll be your guide into the ancient world of the hidden djinn. Welcome. If you've been waiting for a female djinnie that is one of the most efficient at making your wishes come true and who will protect you and love you and bring you all the good things in life, it does not get better than this. She has had some fantastically beautiful times with her previous masters and mistresses and will always love and care for you. She has no morals and her specialty is to make you feel loved and cherished and protect you from all harm. She is extremely good at what she does and is desperate to please you and is willing to be shared if that's what her master desires. All she wants is to pleasure you. You can expect to be romanced, flirted with, massaged, and tied down the way Jin do without anything at all, and then pleasured until you demand her to stop. She is absolutely stunning with a body to die for and golden hair. She also has a beautiful nature. You will never be lonely with her at your side. You will never be sad or have bad luck ever again. Even when you come out of this page, you will be able to close your eyes and see her face. You will feel warm inside and yearn to have her in your life, touching your heart and protecting you against all earthly troubles. All this and more can be yours for just $59.99. That might sound like the most ridiculous, made-up infomercial ever. But what I just read to you is one of hundreds, if not thousands, of actual listings on eBay for an item of jewelry that comes with its very own Jin. There are rings, amulets, all kinds of items. And you can take your pick of the litter, not just with the physical items, but with the kind of Jin that you're looking for. And eBay isn't the only place you can find such items. A South African company called Paranormal Spirits has a wide array of Jin summoning items for sale on, I have to admit, a pretty modern and convincing looking website. You can take your pick of the Jin litter. What do you want that Jin to do for you? Be your lover? Bring you wealth? Destroy your enemies? Paranormal Spirits has it all. 5,000-year-old Norse djinn and 3,000-year-old Egyptian djinn, terrifying ifrit djinn, and seductive harem djinn all come neatly packaged, presumably into the rings that you can buy from them. If you're not a ring person, well, try a spellbound oil, perfume, or an incense that will draw them to you. And if that doesn't work, no worries. You can buy, for a sweet price, a vial of red mercury from the store. The djinn apparently covet red mercury because it helps increase their lifespan. So, if you got yourself a vial, well, it's a perfect bargaining tool to get what you want from them. How exactly you'll get in touch with them to enter negotiations isn't clear, but maybe it comes with an instruction manual. Now look, if you think a pretty bottle of oil or a cheap ring from eBay will bring you the power to lord over the djinn, well, I've got a $14 Ouija board I'd like to sell you. If only summoning the djinn was so easy. Which is why the eBay listings come with buyer beware warnings like this. Law state, I must add that my readings are for entertainment purposes only. You must be at least 18 years old to make this purchase. You agree that any items purchased are subject to your own interpretation. My services are not a substitute for legal, medical, financial, psychiatric, or any other kind of professional service or care. I am not responsible for the outcome of any situation that may occur as a result of any product or service you may purchase from me, or of your participation in any way. By purchasing my services, you are stating that you are aware of and agree to these terms. So, it seems that $59.99 will not exactly get you the Ring of King Solomon. Now, the reliability of online purchases aside, there's no question that throughout all of human history, we have been trying to make contact with the unknown. And we've left behind extensive literature and texts on how to do it, even though invoking the djinn is forbidden by most traditions. But forbidding something, as we all know, just makes the temptation even sweeter. There are those who believe even whispering the known names of the djinn is enough to call them to you. But usually, it takes a lot more than that. Nearly a millennia ago, in the early 11th century, the Persian Sufi scholar and ascetic Muhammad al-Tabasi wrote a treatise called The Comprehensive Compendium to the Entire Sea. A rather misleading title, if you ask me. That's because this treatise is perhaps one of the best known and most widely used not to understand sea creatures, but to subjugate occult forces. Tabasi warns that there are two ways to conjure the djinn, an illicit way and a permissible way. The illicit way is by calling on dark forces and committing heinous and degrading acts like blood sacrifices or sexual deviation. But the legitimate way, according to Tabasi, is by invoking what is pure and sacred. To that end, he cites a range of sacred scriptures such as the Torah, the Gospel, and the Quran. That's also how he gets around the prohibition against conjuring djinn, rationalizing that his spells are in accordance with Islamic law as long as they are performed through virtue and not through sin. The collection of incantations, charms, and the combination of written and recited spells claim to be effective in commanding both angels and djinn, and to obtain supernatural powers through their aid, both for good and nefarious purposes. For the super committed, reciting all the spells will give you command over the entire range of demons that he lists, including the Lady Queen, one of the daughters of the devil, or the Indian demon king, Mahakal. Tabassi himself was famous for his alleged own ability to subjugate the jinn, and that ability drew his contemporaries to him to ask for his help. One well-known story tells of the time the famous Muslim scholar Ghazali asked Tabassi to show him what the jinn looked like. Tabassi did so, and Ghazali saw them as shadows on a wall. Then Ghazali asked Tabassi if he could speak with them, but Tabassi basically responded, maybe another time. Tabassi's book offers precise and specific instructions on how to subjugate the jinn to do your bidding, and in many cases, the spells involve the preparation of charms and talismans. Each spell is different depending on what you're trying to achieve. Do you want to make someone fall in love with you? Are you trying to destroy an enemy? Do you need help from a jinn to ward off evil? Are you searching for the location of something precious? Something or someone you lost, maybe. Your charm might require objects made out of paper, leather, parchment, metal discs and tablets, or jewelry like signet rings. But no worries, Tabassi has you covered. Throughout the book, Tabassi draws out the various magical symbols necessary for the spells and divulges the numerological configurations and incantations needed for success. Some spells require you to invoke the forces of good, angels and prophets and saints, and, of course, God. But in others, Tabassi says you'll have to go to the dark side and invoke the jinn directly, often the most powerful of them, like the seven jinn kings, and their king, Satan himself. While Tabassi's work may reek of heresy to the Orthodox, he was fairly well accepted as part of a long-standing tradition of what were known as jinn binders, those people who possessed the power and knowledge to bend the jinn to their will. Another one of the most famous such jinn binders was Ahmed al-Buni, a 13th century North African mystic who was said to have mastered the esoteric and occult sciences. While there's not much known about him, he left behind more than 40 writings in which he referenced Plato, Aristotle, Hermes, and various Chaldean magicians that he was influenced by. Even today, al-Buni's body of work is among the main sources of occultism, magic, and secret knowledge in Muslim societies. One of those books contains a set of 24 names from the Arabic alphabet used for summoning or conjuration, and they are said to date all the way back to the biblical prophet Enoch, even before being used by King Solomon. So clearly, the pedigree of these invocations is ancient and very well preserved. While it's not hard to get a hold of either al-Buni or Tabassi's texts because they're both easily available online, albeit in their original Arabic, they were never meant for the masses. Al-Buni specifically warned that his books were meant for the select few, those with the wisdom and knowledge to do good by them. Using them for evil would return evil. Using them for good would return good. And beyond that, you also had to have a certain level of spiritual insight and fortitude to get results, because these metaphysical practices only opened portals of power for those who had demonstrated years, if not decades, of spiritual and intellectual discipline. After all, as Hafiz, a 13th century Persian Sufi master and poet, said, quote, "A man must be a Solomon before this magical seal will work." Now, I'm not saying that a layperson wouldn't get anything out of these spells. It's just, well, folks like you and I might not be able to control whatever we inadvertently unleash. There are many reasons someone may want to reach out to the jinn, communicate with them, or even command them to their bidding. One very common one that may not have occurred to you is this: the jinn can help tell the future. Now, to be clear, the jinn on their own have no power to predict the future, none at all. In fact, while the jinn are physically strong, they're believed to be pretty basic in their cognitive abilities. Scholars have said one reason humankind is considered a superior creation to the jinn is because of our ability to imagine. Human beings can conceive of ideas, technologies, possibilities, worlds they've never seen and have never existed, and turn that imagination into reality, whereas the jinn have no such ability. They just know what they know. But they are faster than humans could ever hope to be, and they can flit through different dimensions in the blink of an eye, which is why they're able to help humans that call upon them predict the future in two ways. First, it's said that legions of jinn are connected to one another in a vast cosmic grapevine, and they're able to carry news from one place to another instantly. What happens in one part of the world can immediately be conveyed on the other end of the globe if you're plugged into that grapevine. Now, this might not seem like a big deal in the age of the internet and social media, but imagine being able to do this party trick 100 years ago. But what about the things that haven't happened yet in any part of the world? After all, there have been many people throughout history who have successfully predicted events well into the future. Nostradamus is well known in our part of the world, but hundreds of years before him, there was Al-Bajarbaki, a famous Syrian esoteric seer who predicted dozens of major events through what was called mystical unveiling. People like Al-Bajarbaki weren't very well regarded by the powers that be, however. This is what the famous Orthodox scholar Ibn Khaldun had to say about the fortune teller. In the towns, we find a group of people who strive to make a living out of predicting the future, because they know that the people are most eager to know it. Therefore, they set themselves up in the streets and in shops, and all day long, the women and children of the town, and indeed, many weak-minded men as well, come and ask them to foretell the future for them, how it will affect their business, their rank, their friendships, their enmities, and similar things. There are those who make their predictions from sand writing, geomancy. Others make their predictions by casting pebbles and grains of wheat. Still others make their predictions by looking into mirrors and into water. These are reprehensible things, because their reprehensible character is established by religious law, and because supernatural knowledge is veiled and hidden from human beings. But Al-Bajarbaki wasn't any old corner store fortune teller, divining someone's romantic prospects. He was a seer of the highest order, sometimes predicting global events with incredible specificity, like a prediction about the emergence of a lame Turkic warlord that would take over a vast region to the east. Many of Al-Bajarbaki's predictions were cryptic, though, like this poem. Listen and comprehend letters and their numerical values, and the description, and be understanding like a clever and intelligent person. The Lord of the heavens will tell concerning Egypt and what is to be in Syria, of good things and of tribulations. Alas, Damascus, what descended upon its territory? And then burn of young men and old. Existence is dark, and the land is blacked out. Even the pigeons there mourn on the branches. Oh, poor creatures, is there no helper for the religion? Get up, all of you, and go to Syria, from the plains and the rugged hills. The Arabs of the Iraq and lower and upper Egypt are coming. The firm resolution is to bring death to unbelief in Damascus. Being cryptic was one of the numerous reasons that he was denounced by the Orthodox clergy at the time. They thought he was just a complete fraud, someone who made vague predictions that people could read into, which is a common fortune-telling trick for sure. But more seriously, he was also labeled a heretic, accused of summoning not just the jinn, but entering into a pact with Satan himself, a pact that would give him access to the unseen world of the jinn and to the future. Which takes us to the second way the jinn are able to help humans predict the future, by interfering with divine communications. According to the tradition, wicked jinn will fly as close as they can to the seventh heaven, where the angels are receiving divine commands from God, and essentially, they'll eavesdrop. They aren't able to hear everything clearly, though, because oftentimes they're chased away by the angels. And you may have witnessed this happening yourself, actually, because shooting stars? Well, it's said those stars are being flung by angels at nosy jinn. When the jinn returns to report what they've overheard to the human fortune teller that commissioned their service, they'll make up things to add to their report because remember, they don't always hear everything accurately. They may only have bits and pieces of the whole picture. And that's why when fortunes are told, there are often truths mixed with lies. So again, the jinn on their own are not able to see the future. They have to steal the information from upon high, which they do by breaking the rules. And the person who sent them there is also breaking the rules, which is why Orthodox religious leaders weren't having it. So for this and other religious crimes, Al-Bajarbaki was condemned to death. Of course, he probably also saw that coming, so he fled to safety from Damascus to Egypt. Al-Bajarbaki later returned to Damascus, though, where he died in the year 1324. Oh, and by the way, 50 years after Al-Bajarbaki's death, an undefeated Turkic-Mongolian conqueror emerged, taking over Southwest and Central Asia as the most powerful ruler the vast Muslim world had ever seen. His name was Timur Lane, also known as Timur the Lame. Back in the day, it was pretty well understood that summoning the djinn was the province of the expert, disciplined mystic. But maybe this was just a gatekeeping device to keep a certain class of people uninformed and controllable, and another class of people well-employed and powerful. Well, we no longer live in those times. The internet has democratized the tools necessary to communicate with the djinn, and you don't need an esteemed scholarly intermediary to get right down to it. Spells needed to conjure the djinn are easy to find online. Entire books, including both ancient and more contemporary collections, are yours to have at the click of a button. And there are nearly a dozen pages on a djinn fandom wiki site that provide specific invocations and how many times you're supposed to say them for different djinn. I even found a post on Reddit that tells you exactly how to summon the 7 Djinn King. And on the website whitemagicmastery.com, you can get a book and a webinar for the low fee of $79.95 on what is claimed to be the most powerful invocation of them all, the Birhatiya. While I can't vouch for the website, the Birhatiya invocation heralds back to the time of the biblical prophet Enoch and was passed through King Solomon and is considered the mother of all summonings. There is almost no classical summoning grimoire that doesn't contain it. And one of the reasons it's most powerful is because it calls upon an ancient covenant, taken not with a single djinn, but with all the djinn, as well as the rest of the supernatural world. It's said that the covenant was taken at the gate of Ishtar, one of the 8 gates leading to the innermost part of ancient Babylon, the city whose name literally means the doorway to God. The Magnificent Gate, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, was constructed by the powerful Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II in 575 BCE, and it was the starting point to the procession to the temple of the Mesopotamian deity Marduk, a deity associated with, among other things, magic. So yeah, this covenant goes back a long, long way. It's unbreakable, and it will exist until the end of time. When you use the Birhatiya invocation, all supernatural creations are subject to the pact, including not just the djinn, the good and the bad, but the demons too, and the angels as well. And they must all respond. The conjuration itself is often written in a circular vortex, with the words swirling to the center, ending in a 3x3 cube with letters arranged cryptically in it. But many have written extensively and at length about the conjuration, including Ahmad al-Buni, the 13th century djinn master we talked about earlier, whose book, Shar al-Birhatiya, is seminal in the education of any aspiring djinn binder or sorcerer. While the origins of the spell aren't exactly clear, al-Buni attributes it to King Solomon, and before him, a Jewish mystic by the name of Asaph ben Berechiah, and before him, an unnamed Greek sage. Al-Buni prefaces his book by noting that the spell is obeyed by all spiritual forces, good or bad, and the conjuring itself is fairly uncomplicated. It's a series of 28 Hebrew Syriac names that Al-Buni transliterates to Arabic. But before you get to the actual names, you must precede the invocation by a charge to protective powers. By the greatest and mightiest name which came to be, and the atoms were formed from nothingness, and the light of all lights burst with such power as to create multitudes and multitudes of stars within the womb of the ever-expanding universe. I call you, O mighty and blindingly luminous master angels, Gabriel, Michael, Israfil, and Azrael. I call you, O mighty and blindingly luminous master angels, Tahath Mirlail, Metatron, and Shamthiel, who reside over the armies of spiritual spirits and nations of the djinn, to facilitate for me servants from under your domain who are bound by the covenant of the Birhatiya to assist me in my spiritual and material pursuits and requests. This takes us to the actual invocation itself, because you may be wondering, well, what are those 28 names so powerful that every angel, demon, and supernatural entity in between can't resist? Well, they're none other than some of the most powerful names of God. O Holy, O Everlasting, O self-subsisting, O the adored one, O peace, O victorious, O powerful, O praised one, O merciful, O the one for whom is all the glory. You may not be familiar with the concept of God having many names, and really the names are just descriptors or titles for his attributes and powers, but there's a rich Semitic tradition of calling upon God by using these names. Now, I admit being surprised when I realized that the most powerful conjuring formula in all of history, the one that no jinn could refuse to respond to, was in fact just the names of God. But then again, it makes sense. If you believe in jinn, you believe that God created them. And if he created them, then only he really has the power to compel them. And the way for jinn conjurers to tap into that power is through the names. In the Jewish tradition, God has seven most holy names that, once written, cannot be erased. Beyond these seven, there are dozens of other names ascribed to God. Jewish mystics, the Kabbalists, believe in a powerful formula containing 72 names of God. And then there is one name, the one so powerful and holy that no one's allowed to utter it, the cryptic four-letter tetragrammaton, represented by the letters YHWH, rumored to have been engraved on the ring that gave King Solomon the power to control all the jinn. Now, in the Muslim tradition, there are 99 commonly known names of God, which are often invoked depending on what you're trying to achieve. But they say there is also one name which is the greatest. No one exactly knows what it is. Some say that it's contained somewhere in the 99 names. Some say it's the name Allah itself. Others say it's a 100th name, known only to the prophets and maybe to a few wise sages who guard it with their lives. To me, the mystery behind this name, this most great and powerful name, sounds very much like what is believed about the Tetragrammaton. In the 1920s, British traveler and writer Rosita Forbes spent much time in remote parts of the Muslim world, and her writings often feature stories about jinn and magic, and her encounters with mystics who were well-versed in both. One of them, a Moroccan sage, told her that with the 99 names of God, he could raise a jinn, and with the use of the 100th name, they would grant every wish and prayer. She might have been skeptical if she had not witnessed, on numerous occasions, a summoning herself. In one instance, while in Yemen, she sat with a mystic in the middle of a courtyard next to the tomb of a saint and asked him to summon a jinn. The man drew a large pentagram in the dirt floor, marked it with symbols, and began meditating and silently invoking the names of God. All at once, a man appeared out of nowhere, sitting inside the pentagram. He was pale and dressed like a local, and looked to be sweating profusely. The two men began to talk, but while Forbes could only understand the holy man, the newcomer's language was incomprehensible. She could make out grunts, but understood nothing he was saying to the mystic who had summoned him. And then, just as he appeared, he disappeared. Poof. Forbes wasn't sure what happened during these jinn summonings and admitted maybe she was just getting bamboozled. But, she wrote, quote, "It would be an unprecedented insult to the name of God that they invoked." Summoning a jinn is just the beginning of the relationship, however. I know it's not exactly the easy part, but still, consider what you'd face if you managed to conjure them and then didn't know how to control them. According to the Encyclopedia of Spirit Keeping, Paranormal Collecting, and Magic, there's a simple invocation you need to present to your jinn once it's with you, which goes like this. Last the night, break the day, wake the sun, wake the moon. All bindings through the cosmos, you are unto me, a spirit of my own keeping, a master to servant, so it is a friend to a friend. And just like that, your jinn will be bound to you forever. Some other handy tips to keep things good with your jinn are these. Keep your jinn or the object that it's attached to within 5 feet of you at all times. Keep lavender or iris-scented candles or incense burning as often as possible, because the jinn love those particular aromas. Meditate with your jinn. Getting some quiet time while it's just the two of you strengthens the bonds. Preferably, you want to do this during the hours of the day that the veil between the seen and the unseen is the thinnest. They recommend between 12 a.m. and 1 a.m., 3 p.m. and 4 p.m., or 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. But also, chat with your jinn, especially around the early morning hours, just as dawn breaks. That's when they're the most receptive to creating a rapport. Finally, keep the jinn in your thoughts because they can actually hear them. Open up your life, your worries, your needs, and your wants, all of it to your jinn companion. They're there for you. They want to hear it all and be involved. Once you've conjured and bound your jinn, it's pretty much all yours and won't serve another master. You might think this is too good to be true. After all, don't the jinn want something in return? Well, some jinn just like the attention, affirmation, and companionship. But there is one jinn in particular who demands the ultimate price for making your wishes come true. Your mortal soul. And that jinn, of course, is Satan. Now, there are thousands of people who will willingly concede their souls to Satan for lots of different reasons, and apparently it's not even that tough to do. The Church of Satan, for example, charges just $200 for a lifetime membership. Or rather, I guess, a lifetime plus afterlife membership. The ritual isn't that complicated either. As one young man explained in a 2016 Slate article titled, "The Men Who Love to Worship Satan and Summon Demons," all you have to do is write a letter, sign it in blood, perform some kind of ritual, and then some physical mark shows up on your body, like a scratch or a burn or a welt. And that's it. Your wishes come true, supposedly. This particular young man, who the author decided to call Greg, reported that during the ritual, a crack in the form of an upside-down cross showed up on the candle that he was using, and he mysteriously ended up with 3 scratches on his thigh. Then, after finishing the ritual, Greg laughed in a voice that wasn't his own. He had, he said, given up his soul to the devil 3 years earlier, in the hopes for success in his career, with relationships and making money. The article goes on to explore why young men turn to the occult. Maybe, theorizes the author, as it's become more common for young women to use crystals and paganism, men are finding empowerment in a more masculine, darker expression of the occult, like Satanism and summoning demons. But the article says what happens once a demon is summoned is unclear. These men are often seeking a connection they can draw strength and gain insight from. But they do so taking the risk that once you summon a demon, you cannot close the connection. Some things might be worth the risk, though. The author of this piece was prompted to write it when she got a DM on a dating app from Greg that read, quote, "I've been thinking about summoning Satan to impress you." Yeah, that same Greg who had said he had sold his soul to Satan for better luck with women was still, 3 years later, trying his luck on a dating app. I can't help but think he might want to ask for a refund. But look, we all have our priorities and needs and wants. Many people who want to connect with the supernatural, who are willing to summon jinn no matter the cost, are just kind of curious. Others are desperate. Some are pragmatic. Not long ago, Newsweek Pakistan reported that a scientist employed at a research foundation proposed, seriously, that summoning and subjugating jinns could solve the country's energy-related problems because the creatures are made of fire. So yeah, we all have our reasons. And I admit, I actually hope that they give this a shot. Whether or not they do, or whether or not you do, the jinn may still come around, unsummoned. Because they say when you speak about the jinn, they come to hear what is said. Who knows, maybe they're even listening to this podcast. Thanks for joining us this week. Next week, we'll be back to take you another step into the world of the hidden jinn. Until then, remember, we are not alone. If you loved today's episode, I'm going to ask you a big favor. Please stop by iTunes and leave me a rating and a review, even if it's just one short sentence. Not only is that how other listeners discover the podcast, but it's also what keeps the podcast going. And for every 1,000 reviews that I get on iTunes, I'll release another Patreon episode absolutely free. That's right, we're on Patreon. So if you're a jinn enthusiast, check out the companion Patreon series at patreon.com/hiddenjinn. Again, that's patreon.com/hiddenjinn. And remember, jinn is spelled D-J-I-N-N. That's where you're going to find an amazing series of interviews between me, scholars, experts, artists, historians, and everyday lay people who have had extraordinary experiences with jinn. And everybody can check out the first episode absolutely free. It's me and my husband sharing our jinn stories, and it was a lot of fun. And if you have any jinn stories, well, I'd love to hear from you. Email me at thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. Once again, it's thehiddenjinn, jinn with a D, at gmail.com. And you might just hear back from me, or you might hear your story on this show. And finally, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram with the handle The Hidden Gin. There you can tweet, post, Insta, DM me. I'd love to hear from all of you, and believe me, I read every single message.
The Hidden Gin is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The podcast is written and hosted by Rabia Chaudhry and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Trevor Young, with executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Music for the show was provided by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. Our theme song was created by Patrick Cortez. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.